The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's Author Events Office, and I'm honored to be here to introduce tonight's author, Antonio Damasio. One of the world's leading neuroscientists, Dr. Antonio Damasio has made watershed contributions to the understanding of how our brains process emotions, decisions, and consciousness. He is the David Dornsif Professor of Neuroscience, Psychology, and Philosophy, and director of the Brain and Creativity Institute at the University of Southern California, Los Angeles. His prolific body of work includes scores of scientific articles and several books, including Descartes' Error, The Feeling of What Happens, and The Strange Order of Things. A member of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, Dr. Damasio is the recipient of some of the scientific community's most prestigious awards. He joins us tonight with Feeling and Knowing, Making Minds Conscious, a guide to understanding the phenomenon of consciousness and how it relates to the physical brain. This book combines biology, neuroscience, psychology, and artificial intelligence to unlock the secrets of this mysterious thing floating around behind our eyeballs. One review states, Damasio is a deep thinker familiar with multiple disciplines, and this is as much a work of philosophy as hard science. And it also says that readers will discover rewarding insights. So let's get to those insights, Dr. Damasio. Thank you so much for being here, and I will see you later for the Q&A.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you very much for coming and wanting to listen about books and wanting to listen about science. So here I am. So Jason provided some pointers onto who I am and to the book. And the book is, I think that the title actually helps locate it. Feeling, Knowing, Making Minds Conscious. And what I want is to tell you a little bit about how the book was put together, why, what are my goals, and then some of the substance of what is in the book. And then you can tell me if I succeeded or not. So what the book is, the book actually comes out of something intriguing. And that is a request that came first from my editor. This is a wonderful editor at Pantheon. His name was Dan Frank, because unfortunately, after we were done with the editing, Dan got ill and died of cancer quite recently. So unfortunately, he didn't have the chance of seeing the book that he so wanted to see and published, and the book that he so helped put together. And what Dan Frank asked me is this. He said, look, you have written several books. You're constantly writing scientific articles, which, of course, come out of the work as it develops in the laboratory and involves different collaborators, and you tell a story with data, which is not really the most readable thing for a general reader. It's to be read by other scientists. And then I write these, or have written these other books right now, you know, I think six or seven, and at least five in English. And these books are sort of longish kinds of books, you know, 400 pages. And it's not just the number of pages or words. It's the fact that very often, as you try to explain an idea or a result completely, you want to put all the data because you want people to understand that you're not just pulling, you know, rabbits out of the hat. You're saying something that you believe in because you did the science to make you believe in that science. Things get complicated. And it's difficult sometimes for readers to apprehend the main message, even if you try to summarize it and so forth. So what Dan said was, well, why don't you write a brief book? a book that instead of 400 would have 200 and some pages. And why, instead of giving all of the facts, all of the explanations, everything that is behind and after, you give the essence of the facts. And at first I said, well, I don't know if I can do that. But I thinking about it, I said, this is actually an interesting challenge. At least I can try. And I decided that I was going to do something that I called a haiku of neuroscience. So I was going to take a subject and then chip away everything that I would regard as non-essential, which is pretty much what happens to begin with in a lot of poetry, and certainly happens in Japanese poetry when you think about the idea of a haiku. So you're going to chip away the non-essential and come out with a distillation of what it is that you want to tell, in this case, your reader. And so that's the book that you're going to read, if you want to read it. And the topics of the book are, of course, affect, the things they have to do with feeling and to some degree with motivations and emotions and so forth. It has to do with mind, obviously, and has to do with this fundamental property that we all know we have, which is the property, the possibility of referring anything that is happening to us to ourselves. Each and every one of us has a mind. We perceive things. We think thoughts. We listen to music. We have a particular state we're in, and we refer it to ourselves. We don't think that it belongs to somebody else. It doesn't belong to the person next to us. It's not with our neighbors. It's not even with the people we most love in our lives. It is just for us and with us. That is the essence of this notion of consciousness, is the relation of whatever it is in our mind to ourselves. Now, the business of understanding consciousness goes a long way. In fact, you can find traces of it throughout the history of philosophy, throughout the history of the humanities. People have been devoted, or at least alluded to this problem numerous times, and for good reason, because this is so important, and because it's not immediately apparent how is it that we get this. First of all, it's difficult enough to understand how we get a mind to begin with, but then this property of the mind to be connected with an experience that is very, very close to us, is really connected to our interior, is connected to us and only us. This is, you know, a very difficult problem. And there have been up and downs. There have been people that say, well, it will be understood one day, not now, because obviously the science still needs to grow. And that's a perfectly understandable, or was a perfectly understandable attitude, because after all, if you go back 100 years, did we know how the brain and our organisms put together language? We did not. Did we know how we were able to perceive things in the outside world? We were not. These are all things that have been happening quite recently, certainly over the past 100 years, and in particular over the past 50 years, and in some cases over the past couple of decades. So we have been able to know more and more about all of these different processes that we take for granted, but that in fact permit me to be here using language, in this case the English language, which is already translating my thoughts, which are not in English. They're in no language whatsoever. They're conceptual. They're in the language of my cognition. And there they are running around. And lo and behold, I'm able to translate all this in sentences in the English language. I'm giving them to you as I speak. And you're doing something which is no less dramatic, is that you're listening to this in English. And as my words come out in sentences and paragraphs, you're translating it into your own language, internal language, the language of cognition. And you could be translating this in some other language. For example, I could be speaking to you in a couple of other languages I know, and I could be speaking to you, for example, in an audience in France or in Spain. And you would be doing exactly the same thing that you're doing in this case with this translation from cognition to language, to the English language, from the English language back to cognition in your minds. So this is all very complicated and beautiful. And lo and behold, science, biology in general, because that's what we are, if we are neuroscientists, is biologists, and neuroscience in particular, has had this huge success. So much so that, of course, everybody knows that stories on neuroscience, whether it is in the daily papers or in other journals, are very prominent. And in books in which scientists like me talk about what they have achieved tend to be read by a larger and larger audience. So that's all fine. So what's so different about consciousness? Why are we spending time with consciousness as a sort of separate problem? And the reason is that it is actually a little bit more difficult to conceptualize what's with consciousness relative to other things. And that's sort of the first approach. And then is that there have been thinkers, and I'm thinking especially of philosophers, that have quite dramatically said that this is not going to be understood anytime soon. And in fact, some of them have said this is not going to be understood ever, period. And some of you, I'm sure, have heard about this expression, the hard problem of consciousness, which is not just the hard problem of consciousness. For the philosopher in particular that produced that expression, it's the impossible problem of consciousness. And the idea is that, well, we can be very smart, we can do all the science, but we do it about all the things that are the easy problems. And when it comes to consciousness, we're just going to be spending our time and energy, but we're not going to get there. Well, I don't think that that's the case. I think that there are ways into the problem. And so this book, with its 48 brief chapters, is a sort of first attempt in the direction of making people at least realize that the problem can be conceptualized and can be resolved. And what I'm going to propose, what I have proposed in this book, and I have good news to tell you that after this book was written, we have, of course, continued doing our research, because one thing is writing books, another is doing the research. And the research is already giving additional results that support what we have found and support before and what we have proposed in this book. So feeling and knowing, making minds consciousness, is a result of thinking through prior results in neuroscience, and I'd like to say in neurobiology, because it's a combination of both, and also a way of asking questions that go into the future. I think it's a beginning of a new direction. And of course, some people may disagree. Some people may say, oh, well, he's trying to tell you that he's going to solve the problem of consciousness, but he isn't. And of course, we're open to discussion, and the proof of the pudding, as they say, is in the eating. We're probably not going to eat it today. We're going to come to that conclusion and that decision of whether or not this is a contribution sometime later, after we have time to think back to what I am proposing here. To take away the suspense and make a long story short, I am saying, as the title implies, that the critical issue to understand how consciousness operates for us humans is actually understanding feeling. And in order to make sure that you get my point, and you will get it, of course, in the book, I'm going to have to tell you a little bit about feeling, and I'm going to make sure that you understand the distinction between feeling and other things that sound like feeling, such as affect in general or emotion in particular. Unfortunately, these words, feeling and emotion, tend to be confused. And so here I am saying feeling and knowing, feeling leading to consciousness. And some of you may say, oh, emotion. So what, like being in fear, you know, having a state of fear or a state of anger or a state of joy, and that leads to consciousness? No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a particular class of feelings, which is actually the most fundamental. And curiously, it's something about which I have written, about which we have researched, and it tends to be the neglected part. Everybody's very attentive to emotions because emotions are so dramatic. Emotions are about joy or anger or fear or love, and people have it every day. They have feelings too, but it's so dramatic that it calls the attention to itself. Whereas feelings, especially the feelings I'm going to tell you about, are more discreet, are more quiet. They are in the background. And what am I talking about? I'm talking about feelings such as hunger, which I'm sure you had at lunch, and I hope, and you're probably now getting it. It's later for you. It's, you know, almost dinner time. So you're going to be hungry in no time if you're not now. Thirst, you probably have thirst several times throughout the day and you have wanted to drink something. You may have felt very well during the day, have well-being. That's a feeling. You may have had at some point some pain or some discomfort. And for example, if you have a cold, or hope not, you had COVID, you would have had pain and discomfort and feeling sick. Those are the feelings that I'm talking about. Hunger, thirst, well-being, malaise, sickness, pain, desire. All of these are the fundamental feelings. And look at this collection. It's a collection of feelings that have to do with the state of our lives. And that is the essence. And those are the feelings that I'm talking about that are vital for consciousness. So please concentrate on that. And just one more thing to help dispel the connection to emotions. Feelings are naturally, spontaneously, about experiences. When you say, I have pain, when you say, the state of joy, you are reporting an experience that you have, and all of those experiences are relative to your own body. What you're describing with hunger, thirst, or pain, or well-being is a state of life within your body. That's the critical issue, okay? Now, when you are talking about all of these feelings, you're talking about an experience. It's something that is subjective. And let me call your attention to one more thing. People cannot see your feelings. People can guess your feelings. They can look at you and say, well, you're not feeling well. You're sick. That's fair enough. But that is a guess that people are making about how you look to them, how your actions in your body appear to them. But to you, they're perfectly knowable because those feelings are direct experiences in your subjectivity. And just one more thing, in emotions, that's not the case. Emotions are actions. I like to say that emotions are about theater. We normally classify a good actor, say that somebody's a good actor, if that actor can give us through the actions, actor, action, emotion, the root word is movement, if they convey to you something that is credible and that connects with what you presume is the mind state of that person in a certain circumstance. So emotions are concerts of actions. It's theater. It's for the outside. Feelings are subjective, are experiences, and are in the inside. So now you know almost everything that you need to know to go to the next step. And the next step is this. When you have pain or hunger or thirst or desire of some kind, these experiences, are they useful or not to you? The answer is obviously they are. If you were deprived of having the experience, the feeling of hunger or thirst or pain, you would not be alive for very long. You might last a couple of days, you know, with good medical help, but you would die. And if you have, for example, pain that is caused by trauma or by a myocardial infarction or by some other disease that you have, unless you go to the hospital and you're treated for the causes of that pain, you're out. So the answer to my question, are feelings useful? You bet they're useful. You bet your life depends on them. And now the next question, why is it that they're useful? Well, they're useful because they are conscious, because they are naturally, spontaneously conscious. If they were not conscious, you would not know that they existed, you would not know that you were in pain, or you would not know that you were so well that you would spend your time doing other things rather than taking care of yourself. Now, this is very important, and I'm afraid that people that have dealt with the problem of consciousness have not concentrated on this issue, and they have not paid attention to the fact that feelings are naturally, spontaneously conscious. So one thing that I like to say, and that this book really is trying quietly, without screaming, telling you, is that feelings are the inaugural event of consciousness. That's important. It's literally an inauguration. There was no consciousness before. So in evolution, everything went on up to the point where organisms were complex enough and had a nervous system, and that way they could produce this marvel that changed the course of evolution and of history, and that is feelings with its consciousness. So that's a very important point. And as I said this, I already revealed a part of the message that I want you to get, and that is that you get the appearance of feelings in the long history of evolution once organisms are complex enough, and once organisms in the middle of that complexity have developed something quite new, which is nervous systems. So what I'm saying here, and I want to emphasize this, is that I don't think that organisms that are very simple and that are alive, of course, but do not have great complexity and do not have nervous systems, I don't think those organisms are conscious. I do think we are, and I do think lots of other species are, and that's because of these two things, the combination of a certain degree of complexity, the presence of a nervous system, and the need of that nervous system and that living organism to produce by their combination a way to maintain your life for as long as your genome will allow. So those circumstances need to be met. So if you ask me, are bacteria conscious? I would say no. And if you ask me, are they stupid? No, they're not. Bacteria are actually very intelligent. But I put intelligent in quotes because their intelligence is not an intelligence that they know exists. They're not aware of how intelligent they are. They don't know they're intelligent. They don't have a mind to represent their intelligence. Yet they're being intelligent in a covert way. It's sort of implicit, and we don't see how it's operating. Of course, we now know through the study of the biological mechanisms, we have a little bit of an idea of how the chemistry in those organisms is operating and is making those organisms have smartness. But it's not a smartness that they know themselves exist. Whereas we know, for example, if we avoid a conflict, or if we avoid, or for example, if we vaccinate ourselves and use masks to prevent a disease, we're doing something intelligent, but we know why we're doing it. There's a very good reason for that. So I think that those organisms are a different story. They are not conscious. Take the example of plants. Are plants conscious? Well, are they intelligent? You bet they are intelligent. Plants and shrubs and trees, all of these living organisms that, like us, have a birth and a life and a death, these organisms go through life showing their intelligence, doing things that are quite reasonable and valuable for themselves and to maintain their lives. So this is all well and good. And yet, are plants conscious? I would say no. Do they have nervous systems? No. So they have a lot of complexity. They have intelligent behavior. And yet, I think they don't know about that behavior. They have no way of representing. They have no mind, no mental representation of what they're doing right or wrong, and generally right. So these ought to put you in mind that there are different grades and levels that we can find when you look at the marvelous history of biology. And you go all the way from creatures that are smart, but they don't know they are smart. They have intelligence, but they don't have minds. They don't have consciousness. They don't have nervous system. And then they have creatures that have nervous systems, but probably don't have minds quite yet. And then you have creatures that have nervous systems and are representing their own states. And there you have the emergence of feeling, which is really the emergence of consciousness. And this is very beautiful. And I think it's a marvelous story. And it gives you an entry into the problem of consciousness. Why do I think so? And I don't want to tire you for too long, but I want to see if I can get across this idea. Most of the declarations of inability to solve the problem of consciousness, this hard, insoluble problem, actually come from very thoughtful, intelligent, capable, marvelous colleagues. I respect them very much, and I'm actually friends with several of them. We just disagree, but we have a polite disagreement. But where did they get this idea? They got this idea because they started out with something as complicated as our vision. Now, of course, presumably you're looking at me on the screen, and so it's obviously a marvel of our visual systems to be able to see on the screen something that was conveyed through the internet, and that allows you to get a picture of who I am and to see me here in my study in Los Angeles with books and paintings behind me. Now, that is really a remarkable development of our nervous system, this ability to hone in on the outside world, and either through hearing, because you are hearing me in a language, even with an accent, not only that, and you are translating all that into your thinking. So you're making images, you're making pictures of all of this stuff that is in the outside world. And all of this is extremely complex. And the people that in the past 50 years have been able to show us how the nervous system, how our cerebrum is capable of doing this, have really been remarkable scientists. Now, because of the success people have had in understanding vision, for example, or language, and other aspects of the perception, such as hearing, people have said, well, this is so complicated, so beautiful, so refined, that something like consciousness, which must be very refined because it's complicated and beautiful, this must have been also the origin. And so where we should be looking for the basis for consciousness is exactly in this very high level process of our brains, which allows us to see and to hear and to raciocinate and to have reasoning and creativity and to use languages, all of this spectacular complexity that the human brain clearly is delivering. And my friends, this is where I depart from this strategy and I say, no, this is wrong. And by the way, everybody that has tried to do it that way, coming from the top, the complexity, to understand what consciousness could be, ends up finding that it's not easy, it's not possible, and that therefore consciousness must be so mysterious, we better think that it's outside of our scope. And so what I'm trying to do, and time will decide if I'm correct or not, what I'm trying to do is go the opposite way. I'm starting from the simple. I'm starting from feeling. I'm starting from this, as I call it, inaugural ability of representing the state of life in our body and saying, well, if this is conscious of necessity, naturally, spontaneously, and we know it is, this is not something to be discussed. Feelings are conscious, okay? That, at that point, we can all agree. Then my reasoning is, when you think about how feelings were put together, they're not being put together by having an extremely sophisticated organ of perception like our retina. They're being created by a marriage of the nervous system that that is, of course, in our brains, and the way in which that nervous system can probe the state of our body everywhere in that entire body. So what we have here is point number one, feeling is dependent not on appreciating what's in the outside world, but on appreciating what is inside our own organism. And so here you get something very bizarre. You have the nervous system appreciating what is inside the organism, where that nervous system also is. So we have a possibility of interaction so that the nervous system can look into the body in every nook and cranny of the body, and that every nook and cranny of the body can talk back to the nervous system. This is completely different from what happens with the outside world. The outside world is out there, fine and dandy, but it doesn't come into my body. I get representations of it in my retina or in my ears, but I do not allow the outside world to enter my body. However, I perfectly allow my body to be entered by every aspect of nerves that comes from our brain, and it distributes itself in every little bit of skin and arterioles and arteries and muscles and viscera like the heart or the lung or the gut. So in our organisms, we have a remarkable different mechanism to make feelings from the mechanism with which we make perceptions of the outside world. Conclusion. First, feelings are not perceptions in the typical sense of the term. Feelings are conversations, dialogues between the nervous system and the body, and they have a back and forth. So they are really a commingling of the two. And this is very different from my looking out at the scenery outside my windows. The scenery is there. I'm not interfering with the mountains or the trees or the buildings. They're there, I'm here. And this is a distant, it's a tele sense, okay? As much tele as you are having seen me on some screen, I'm here, and it's very far away. You're not interacting with me physically. Feeling, different story. There's that full interaction. And then the last point is that it's out of that interaction and out of the way the nervous system is put together for the purposes of interoception, which is this ability to investigate the interior. It's out of that particular nature of that nervous system that we get our feelings. And that is really quite distinct. And we know now, and this is where science comes in and helps the argument, we know now that that nervous system is simpler, that that nervous system is not as modern and well-insulated as, for example, the visual or the auditory system, and that literally this idea that you might say, it's a bit romantic, this idea of nerves talking to the gut. Well, this is not romance. This is something that is happening because we know that the nerves are immediately vulnerable to molecules that are in the surround, and that there can actually be a cross conversation between body, quote unquote, and brain on the other side. So this is the essence of what I want to express in the book, and the gives you a sort of entry into this thinking. And I hope if you're interested in this topic that you go and read the rest, because you'll learn more. And as I said, time will tell. I hope I'm right, of course, who doesn't? And I have a suspicion that I am. Sorry to be a little bit conceited, but I better be conceited since I've just finished the book, right? So thank you very much for your attention and for your patience. And if Jason wants to come back and ask me questions, I'm here.
Thank you very much for that. That was fascinating. If people don't mind, I was reading a bit of the book, and I'm sure it's something that people have asked you about, and I'm sure you've been writing it a while, but there is the embarrassment of viruses you talk about, and you say something, how to classify viruses and understand their role in the general economy of life. Are viruses alive? No. And I know you were speaking about bacteria to a certain degree. And I just wonder, not that the pandemic or the coronavirus has complicated necessarily your thinking about this notion, but has it complicated the way other people approach your discipline from outside it, or you know, maybe even others within?
Yeah, it's a very, very good point. It's very timely. Clearly, by the way, when I wrote that, we were not yet in COVID, so it antecedes it. But my preoccupation, as I laid out this book and my previous book, also called The Strange Order of Things, it's the fact that you have all of these manifestations of our very rich biology, and you need to know what's what in order to make sense of what these different organisms can or cannot do. And so in the case of bacteria, you have really living forms that are very simple and that don't have a nervous system, but are alive in the proper sense. With viruses, it's different because viruses are not quite alive in the proper sense. They have nucleic acids and they can do a lot of harm, as we know, from all the terrible diseases that they constantly create, including COVID, but they are not of the same level. So in fact, when we in a very colloquial way say we need to kill those viruses, you cannot kill a thing that is not alive, but they are there and they are components of what constitutes life, and they can do a lot of harm once they enter cells, and basically they're entering cells and being unwelcome guests because they, not being alive, don't have the conditions to maintain their own status. So they need to be parasitic of other organisms, quote unquote. So that's the whole story. And then it's nice to be able to contrast this with complicated creatures, whether you're talking about a simple fly or a dog or a creature like we are.
Thank you. So this question is from Theodore. He asked, emotion researchers use different definitions of the word emotion. What is your definition of emotion?
My definition of emotion is a collection of actions that represents a particular state of the organism, and that translates for the outside world something about the state of the organ. So let's give the example of the emotion fear. When you are in fear, there's some threat, that somebody's attacking you. And what happens is that you have a collection of actions. For example, you recoil. If you're under attack, you sort of pull yourself back. Very often your eyes open up, your mouth can open, and there are actions that are also happening in the inside. Like, for example, there's a contraction of arteries, there's an acceleration of heart rate, there's a contraction of the gut. There are all sorts of actions, always actions, that are happening in your organism and that are triggered by the presence of that stimulus which posed a threat to you. And what's very interesting is that as a result of all of these actions, you're also going to feel fear. So not only do you act fear for the outside world, but you are in fear as an experience. And so the best definition that I can give you of emotion is a collection of actions that has been, through evolution and in different species, created a sort of pattern that allows that creature to respond more effectively, and that also allows other creatures to recognize the state that that particular creature is in. So it goes both ways. You alter, you affect yourself because you're being threatened, and you also betray that fear, that concern resulting from the threat to the outside world, and then you feel accordingly. But that feeling that you have is secondary to the actions that have happened in your body. Whereas hunger or thirst sexual attraction, those are feelings that are consequent to actions that happen in the inside and that are being expressed mentally for you and that only you know about. And of course, if you are heads over heels in love, you will also look like you are heads over heels in love. But that's, you could actually mask it. You might not betray it to the outside world. Whereas if you are terrified, it's very difficult to not show that to the outside world. You're going to have something that automatically happens in your facial expressions that makes people know that you are afraid, okay? But you can be very hungry and not show that you're hungry. You could be very polite to the people who invited you for dinner, and instead of saying, "Where's dinner? I want to eat," you just stay there waiting calmly until you're served dinner.
Francisco, who sends his admiration from Buenos Aires, says, "I'm very grateful for this opportunity. I read the book, and I'd like to ask if we could relate the three distinct," this might be a professional question, "if we could relate the three distinct and consecutive evolutionary stages, those being being, feeling, knowing, that are presented with Charles Sanders Peirce's ideas about triads, feeling, and cognition. Thank you very much."
That's a beautiful question. First of all, hello to Buenos Aires. That's great. I didn't know that you people in Philadelphia go far and wide. My God, I thought
you have a wide reach.
You're amazing. It's very interesting. I'm going to give you a very honest answer. I read Charles Peirce early in my life, thanks to the influence of one of my mentors. And I thought it was extremely complicated. And I will confess to you that I've never gone back to Mr. Peirce. So to give you an honest answer and an informed answer, I would have to review that. I have a suspicion, just from the way you asked me the question, and from what I remember, that probably there could be a considerable connection. I'm going to make a note here, and I'm going to have to go to him, and I thank you. And maybe I can, when I have the answer, I'll write to Jason. Jason writes to you. Thank you.
This question is from Rick. He asks, "Why were feelings previously ignored in the discussion of consciousness?"
That's a splendid question. Okay. The full why, I don't know if I can say it, but I have several candidates. First, feelings, as we have just seen, are interior, private events. There's been a long tradition in the history of science and even in the history of philosophy of trying to, if not ignore, to minimize the importance of affect. In fact, one of the first, after my research got more and more oriented towards things that had to do with affect, I wrote a book that is quite well known called Descartes' Error. And Descartes' Error is all about this issue. It's the issue that states of affect, feelings and emotions, were neglected in the history of science. And this continues to be the case. Although today there's far more of an acknowledgement that feelings are important and that emotions are important, because clearly people suffer, people have pains, people have joys, and people recognize that the world of affect is a very primary world, and that a lot of the things that happen in the world of reasoning and creativity are in fact dependent on what state you're in terms of affect. So there's some people that still look askance at feeling, but fortunately in the general culture, that's been diminishing. Within the world of science, clearly the power has been on the side of the people who study cognition in general. And I don't have any problem with that. We need to understand how we think, we need to understand how we reason, we need to understand languages, we need to understand perception in all its details. So that's perfectly reasonable to do, but we should not neglect affect. And I think more and more, I very often have the impression, certainly when I was at the beginning of my career, the impression was of condescension. So people would say, oh, well, Damasio wants to talk about emotions. Let the poor man talk about emotions because that's his interest. And there was not an acknowledgement that that would be a sort of equal player. And now that has changed and people are much more open to see that this is important. Now, that is going to play a role in the reaction that people have about for these ideas, because by trying to link consciousness, which has been sort of the pinnacle of cognitivism, to feeling, which is this bottom stage process, I think that's going to be a little bit difficult for some people to stomach, although so far, the reaction that I've had is exactly the opposite. People have been extremely welcoming to the idea. Even when they don't think it will work, they say, well, maybe we should just listen to it and let's play it out. Let's see what the data tell you. Because in the end, it's not going to be that this is not a beauty contest. This is about where the facts are. And if the facts are in support of feeling, that's what it is. But as the person who asked the question knows very well, feelings were not in fashion, and now they are a bit more.
Thank you. Let's get very specific in this one. I'm jumping around a bit, so I'm going to try and get to as many folks as I can. Is there evidence that jellyfish or worms experience hunger? And I suppose taking that a little broader, how do we know that organisms, quote unquote, simpler organisms such as jellyfish, worms, stuff like that, experience things like this?
Right. Okay, that's an absolutely excellent question. But here's what I would do, I would suggest as a test. And this is something actually is one of the interests of our lab, of our institute, sort of mapping out what could and could not experience feelings in terms of its status biologically. So first, you need to have a certain degree of complexity in an organism. Second, you need to have a nervous system. Then if you especially ask something specific like hunger or thirst, you need to have a way, a system that is in charge of digestion, for example. And that has to be sufficiently defined that there could be something like feeling about it that would have the recognition of what was wrong in that system, although the recognition could come out of a simple molecular mechanism. It doesn't need to be, say, a stomach making noises and contracting, or a gut, it can be the balance of molecules at a particular point. But my inclination is to be as liberal as possible on the way down. So I'm ready to think that very simple organisms, for example, flies, animals that have actually a very small but very complex nervous system, will have feelings that will be somewhat similar to our feelings. I don't have any problem with that. So the same way that I'm quite negative in relation to the possibilities of plants, not that I don't respect them, on the contrary, and I am very negative in relation to the possibility of artificial intelligence ever coming up with feelings like our feelings, because in order to make a robot feel the way we do, we need to first make the robot alive. And if the robot is alive, then we don't have any problem. So it's an absurd situation. We can make, however, a robot do things that are similar to the things that are in emotions and have states that are somewhat similar to the physiology of feelings, but it doesn't mean that they would feel, because that's absurd. But I'm very open to a lot of small organisms. And certainly, and I think this is very important, it's quite important to believe, because this, I think, is sound science, that a lot of the living organisms that are not human and are around us are, in fact, feeling creatures. And it's not just domestic animals, but also the animals that are out in the fields and the animals that are out in the sea. And the likelihood that they would not have feelings is actually, as far as I'm concerned, very low. Do they feel exactly like us? Probably not. They don't have minds as rich as ours, but they have feelings, I think. And if they have feelings, they certainly have emotions too, in relation, for example, if they are in pain, if you attack one of those animals and they clearly must be in pain, predictably, and the way they look, the way they seem to behave for us is a way in which there's quite a lot of similarity to what we do. They appear to be suffering. Well, if they appear to be suffering, why not be generous and presume they're suffering? And I think this is very, very important in terms of the way we behave in relation to animals around us. It's a point that is a very sore one, because people have been very open and careless about how they treat animals, except if they love them and they think the animals love them. If they think the animal loves them, how could the animal not have feelings? Okay, so we need to take these problems very, very seriously and very upfront.
Actually, I think you even answered a couple of our other questions there. Do dogs have consciousness? So there we go. That was from Marcia. And I don't want to mispronounce the name, Burke. So what is the most primitive organism that we can clearly attribute some consciousness to? So there's a question here that says, briefly, can you give us an idea of what types of research, perhaps even outside of this, you know, specific field, support your understanding of consciousness, or within as well?
So several types of research. I'll tell you about the one that we are practicing, in the one that is very important to us, which is to understand at the micro level the physiology of feeling. So what is it when you have an organism? What is it that happens, for example, in a nerve trunk? What happens, for example, we know that there are nerves that will, say, come out of your leg and will go into a spinal ganglion next to your spinal cord. And that nerve needs to make contact with the ganglion, and the ganglion then sends messages into the spinal cord and then up the spinal cord into nuclei in the brainstem in the brain. We now can make this anatomy clear, and we need to know more about the physiological phenomena within that anatomy. What's really happening at those synapses? For example, are there signals that are being presented to the nerves outside of synaptic contexts? in the middle of the exon, for example, which we think there are? Are there parts of the organism that are non-neural that are making, that are having an influence on the neural parts, which again, we have evidence is the case because in spinal ganglia, there's a lack of blood-brain barrier. See, for example, our brain, our cerebrum, is completely surrounded by this particular set of membranes that is called the blood-brain barrier. And what this means is that the bloodstream, with all of the stuff that is coursing in the bloodstream, all the chemistries that are there, is not going to impinge on the brain directly, because that would be a big mess. You would have chemical influences on the neurons, and we don't want that. We want to preserve that territory. It's like having a border. Now, that big blood-brain barrier, lo and behold, is lacking on the ganglia that go into the nervous system. Now, that is very interesting because it's saying to us, well, there you are. Remember how I mentioned this marriage of body and brain, this marriage of nervous system and our flesh. And that would be an indication, there is an indication that that marriage does occur. But we know this in these general terms. We need to know more about the detail and what happens to the firing of neurons and so forth. So that's, for me, the most important avenue to sort of try to make the point. There's one other, which is very interesting, is that people that are studying how simple organisms operate and how the nervous systems of those organisms operate have a very remarkable possibility of understanding the relationships of those simple nervous systems to the structure of those organisms. And for example, there's some indication that the one very important point of entry into the nervous system happens to be organs of an organism that are related to important things such as, for example, digestion, feeding and digestion, which nobody can say is not important, because if you people don't go and have dinner at some point, you're going to be in trouble. So that's the reason why feelings of hunger work, and that's the reason why this has to do with consciousness, and time will tell how right this hypothesis will turn out to be.
Okay, well, we are about at time, but I just wanted, so you had a person who asked several questions, several comments, and just wanted to say, TC Ravens says, thank you, your books have enriched my life and view of the world. So just wanted to get to that and
thank you.
Get that across. And yeah, and so too with all of us. So I just wanted to thank you on behalf of myself, the library, our viewing audience, for joining us tonight, and hope everybody goes out and gets feeling and knowing, making minds conscious. And Professor Damasio, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, and thank you to you, and thank for the questions. They were very interesting.
The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series. Recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.